This is continuing coverage in the trial of Alex Murdaugh from True Crime Today.
Welcome back to our continuing coverage. I'm Tony Bruschi. Be sure to press subscribe so you don't miss any of our coverage of the Alex Murdaugh trial. Let's head to the courtroom for segment number two.
Cross-examination.
Can I call you Buster?
Yes, sir.
I'm John.
And I want to first off tell you, I am sorry about your mother.
Sorry, I can't hear him drunk.
I'm sorry about his mother.
If you step back, we'll have to hear you.
And I'm sorry about your brother.
Thank you.
And I'm sorry about your grandfather.
Thank you.
He was nice to me when I was a young assistant solicitor. I'm sorry for your loss.
Yes, sir. I appreciate it. Thank you.
I don't have any questions for you, Buster.
Okay.
When you are leaving the main house, you told Mr. Griffin that the main entrance was the brick entrance?
Yes, sir.
But there's also a side entrance or by the kennels or entrance exit.
Yes, sir. Okay. Just a totally different entrance.
And the mailbox was at the side entrance?
Yes, sir.
The kennel entrance?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Why was that? Do you know?
I don't know. I think it's just I really don't know.
Okay. I don't either. But the packages would come to, you said, the kennel side?
They would come to the shed. Okay.
And a lot of times y'all would use that kennel entrance exit to go just like you'd use the main one, right?
Yeah, you would. I would say that I more so tended to use the main one, the one that I say is the brick pillars. But yeah, I mean, you could certainly leave either way.
If you were leaving the main entrance,
mm-hmm.
and you got down, you're leaning the house and you're going toward the brick, and then you know where it's kind of a wire, it kind of cuts off to the kennel too, right?
Sure.
So you go straight or left. If you were leaving at night going straight, and if you were looking out to the left and the lights were on, you'd be able to see the lights on at the kennel just from that little wire, wouldn't you?
Maybe, depending on what lights were on and whatnot. I mean, if it was fully lit up, maybe.
And just from that wire, instead of going straight, from that distance, you'd be able to, if the lights were on fully, you'd probably be able to see them.
Maybe, yes, sir.
Almeda, where your grandma and granddaddy were, is that close to the, I think it's close to the law firm, isn't it?
Almeda?
Yes. Sir.
Close to the law firm? I wouldn't say so. I mean, anywhere in Hampton is close to anywhere in Hampton because it's not very big.
Fair enough.
But, I mean, it's a 10 minute, 12 minute drive out to Almeda, I would think, from the law firm.
Mr. Duffy, did you bring up 131? Can I ask him to do that? I know Mr. Harper gets exposed. I said, sure. So you don't have to get, but you see, is this kind of where you said everybody would park?
It's right. So if you look. No, sir, you can't. So if you look right off this point,
you might want to come down here if you don't mind.
Just the jury.
So if you look right over here, this is kind of what I'm referring to as like the back corner of the house. And it would basically, you would come around, there's a big oak tree here, you come around it, and then you basically pull up, and you would probably stop the hood of your car right in, you know, right off the back corner of the house.
So it'd be closer to here than over here?
Be about right in here.
So right in here?
Yeah, I mean, because you don't want to pull up super close to it. Yeah, be right out.
Okay.
Right,
but there was a driveway all in, paved driveway in here, right?
There is a paved driveway over towards the side of the house.
Okay, and really not many tire tracks. The grass looks good in here.
don't know when these pictures were taken, but it's a little dead right there.
But there is a driveway, right?
There is a driveway.
Okay, you can have a seat, man. Thank you, please.
When did you first mention that to anybody about parking in the yard there?
What do you mean?
I mean, like, when did you first discuss that with anybody as far as where cars parked at your grandma and granddad's house? When was the first time you talked to anybody about that?
A couple days ago.
A couple days ago?
Okay.
That's the first time you mentioned that?
Sure.
Okay. And then that would have been after Shelley testified, right? Shelley Smith?
I guess. I don't really remember when Ms. Smith testified.
Ms. Smith. Did you bring that to somebody's attention or did somebody ask you about it?
I couldn't. I'm not sure.
And I think you keep forgetting I'm on cross. You testified that how many times had you been there with your dad? I wasn't quite clear with your answers to Mr. Griffin. I'm not trying to be difficult, Buster.
I understand, and I can't give you an approximate number, but I mean, I've been out there with him several times.
And, would you always call? You said you called. Did you always call when you got there?
Yeah, I feel like most of the time you would call just to tell, you know, because the ladies get nervous, you know, if you hadn't called and they see a car pulling in the driveway, you know, it's just easier to call and let them know, like, hey, we're going to be pulling around. You know, please unlock the door. We'd like to come in.
Had you ever been over there at 6:30 in the morning?
Have I ever been out there at 6:30 in the morning?
I guess.
I've been out there at 6:30 in the morning before going hunting and whatnot.
You called then also then, right?
Well, that was
going into the house.
Yeah, sure.
I would just let them know, especially 6:30 in the morning.
Sure.
Your mom loved Edisto, didn't she?
Yes, sir, she did.
I love Edisto. She was actually getting some work done down there, wasn't she?
Yes, sir, she was getting some work done on the house.
And on this date, June 7th, literally there were people inside doing work that day, weren't they?
I think so.
Yeah. And her plan was to stay down there that night, wasn't it?
I don't know. I don't know what her plan was.
You had, I think the last time you'd been to Moselle, you said was the spring, maybe a few months prior to this?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And you have to say yes for the court reporter, not for me.
Yes. Sorry.
And you talked to your mom that day on June 7th?
Yes, sir.
And I think you talked to Paul the last time on the 5th, if I'm not mistaken. June 5th is what you told him on the interview.
Sure.
And Mr. Griffiths asked you about the financial troubles and that have come out here. You had no knowledge of your dad's financial difficulties at all, did you?
No, sir.
I mean, you really didn't?
No, sir. I really didn't.
And as far as you knew, financially, the family was sound?
Yes, sir.
You went to Wofford?
I did go to Wofford.
Go Terriers, for the record.
Thank you.
But everything, as far as you knew, financially was okay. And when did you learn it wasn't?
I guess on September the whatever that day in September was.
So back in the birthday, I guess for your dad, Memorial Day. Down at Edisto?
Sure.
Defense exhibit, and I apologize, I don't know what number it was just played. I believe a Mr. Chris Wilson is hugging your dad?
Yes, sir.
Okay. He's a family friend?
Yes, sir.
Okay. You didn't know then that he owed your dad owed Chris Wilson or stole $192,000 from him, did you?
I did not.
And I'm not saying that'd be mean, but you really didn't know that.
That's correct. Didn't know.
And this boating, the boating accident that Mr. Griffin asked you about, that was pressure on the family, wasn't it?
I don't know that pressure's the right word. I mean, it's definitely an uneasy feeling. You know, your brother is criminally charged, and then you, myself, and my father have civil charges. I mean, definitely unsettling.
I mean, it caused stress within the family, didn't it?
It was stressful. I wouldn't say within the family because, I mean, you know, we supported each other.
And I'm not questioning that, but I mean, your mom felt ostracized?
Yes, sir.
She even more so wanted to stay at Edisto?
Yes, sir.
It really... I mean, you were a little frustrated with Paul yourself, weren't you?
In terms of
using your ID and getting all that. And that case is over, okay?
Sure.
But, I mean, you didn't like it when you used your ID yourself. I'm not trying to go anywhere, Buster, but he'd use your ID sometime and you didn't want him to.
Questions you're going to ask. Okay. Questions, comments, what's the question?
What's the question?
Did you like it? Did he used your ID, didn't he?
Jackson, no.
Jackson's over with.
I'm sorry, can you say it again?
Did Paul use your identification?
Yes.
Did that frustrate you?
Sometimes.
You were shown the tree video with the shirt and the pants. You remember that?
Yes, sir.
When you saw your dad on the night of June 7th, what did he have on?
When I had made my way up to the house, he was wearing shorts and a T-shirt.
And who laundered his clothes?
At that period of time, would have been Blanca. And then my mom also does laundry sometimes.
But on a day-to-day, did Blanca take care of your dad's clothes, laundering, cleaning, folding?
Yes, sir.
And Mr. Griffin asked you about... how did he do that? You never went back to Mazzell after this incident?
Well, I mean, after...
Or did you?
If you take June 7th, on June, I mean, I've been back to Mazzell since then, but I've never slept another night at Mazzell.
And did your dad... Let's strike that. Big portion, though. Beg court's indulgence. Did your dad try to get you to go hunting out there again one time or suggest it?
He asked if I wanted to, and if I wanted to, that I could.
But you didn't want to?
No, sir. Didn't want to go.
That's all I have. Thank you, Buster.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Redirect.
Buster, if
your mother, when she went to Edisto and stayed for multiple nights, would she take Bubba with her?
Yeah, usually. She'd take a combination of Bubba and maybe another dog, Grady. Okay. She would take dogs with her, yes.
And you understand Bubba and Grady were at Moselle the night of June 7th.
Right? I do. Yes, sir.
That's all I have.
Anything further? Thank you. Let me sit down. Your next witness.
Put your left hand on the Bible and raise your right. Do you swear or affirm the testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Thank you. You'll have a seat up there on the witness stand. Adjust that microphone and pull it closer to you if you need to. Pull your seat up, but state your name for the record and spell your last name, please.
Mike Sutton, S-U-T-T-O-N.
Mr. Sutton, what do you do for a living?
I'm a forensic engineer.
A forensic engineer. Now, what is a forensic engineer?
Well, the majority of the work that I do involves the investigation of accidents and failures. In the field of legal questions, legal problems, court of law. So what forensic engineers do is that they collect data, collect physical evidence, they interpret the data, and then try to come up with what happened in an event, maybe what didn't happen in an event, or maybe try to limit the possibilities of what happened in an event.
Okay, and do you have educational background in this area, or have you been trained, or how about just tell us, first of all, where you, as we say around here, where are you from?
Well, I was born in Hickory, North Carolina. Then I grew up in Cary. When I was young, family moved to Cary, which is right outside of Raleigh. When I graduated from Cary High School, I went to North Carolina State University, and I was in the materials engineering department for about a year. My sophomore year, I transferred over to the mechanical engineering department. And so I was at NC State from my undergraduate from 84 to 88. When I was a sophomore, I met an engineer. His name is Dr. Charles Manning, who owns a company still in Raleigh. He's passed away, but his company's still there. And Dr. Manning was an ex-professor at State. He's also an ex-NASA engineer. And I worked with him from basically 1987. Then after I graduated, I went full-time with him.
When you graduated, you graduated with a degree in what?
In mechanical engineering.
Okay, and you were working with him?
Working with him, and I continued to work with him, and then I got a master's degree at North Carolina State University, also in mechanical engineering, with a concentration in acoustics and vibrations.
In acoustics and vibrations?
Correct.
Your master's? Okay.
Yes.
And then what did you do?
Well, I worked with him as a consulting engineer, consulting forensic engineer, looking at all different kinds of accidents and failures, about anything that you can imagine. We do a lot of motor vehicle accidents, of course, because there's so many. We look at structural failures, product failures, material failures, about anything that you can imagine. But basically, if there's anything that's based in physics, it's capable of being explained and understood.
And what do you mean by physics?
Well, physics are the laws that govern how things around us, how they behave. You can predict their behavior. If I drop a basketball off of a balcony, I can predict how long it's going to take to reach the ground based on all the different variables. So the laws of physics are there. It helps us figure out how things would happen. So I worked with Dr. Manning for a while until end of 2000. And in 2001, I founded my current company, which is based in Cary. It's called Accident Research Specialists.
What's the name of it again?
Accident Research Specialists in Cary, okay. North Carolina. And we do the same thing. There are 10 engineers that I work with and support staff, and we investigate, analyze a variety of cases for a variety of clients. Like I said, most of my work is related to either criminal cases or civil cases, and I do some consulting that's not related to courtroom issues, just straight consulting to companies.
Have you, from time to time, dealt with shooting incident reconstruction?
Yes, I have.
And tell the jury what shooting incident reconstruction is.
Well, the shooting incident reconstruction, at least how I'm involved with it, I deal with what would be called external ballistics. and terminal ballistics. So external ballistics are the flight of a bullet after it leaves a gun. A bullet leaving the barrel of a gun, it's going to be affected upon by gravity, air resistance. So that's just physics. And then there's terminal ballistics, which is what happens to a projectile when it strikes a target or an object.
And how many times have you been involved in a case involving shooting instant reconstruction?
I would say over the years, maybe 50.
Okay.
Now, all different kinds. Like, for instance, it could be a case where a manufacturer is being sued for like a drop fire where somebody dropped a pistol and it went off.
And it's not supposed to do that.
No. And so it could be a products case. I've worked on cases involving hunters, you know, long range distance shots where you're trying to figure out where a particular hunter was aiming the gun, so he killed somebody. I've worked certainly in law enforcement shootings. I've worked for law enforcement, and I've worked on the side opposite law enforcement for people who have been shot by law enforcement. I've worked on insurance cases. Sometimes there's a question about whether it was a suicide or an accident. So those are the type of cases that I would be involved with.
And when you do these cases, you're looking for, I mean, what's the difference between you and a crime scene reconstructionist?
Well, crime scene reconstructionist would be looking at a lot of different things. So I'm a mechanical engineer. I deal with physics. But somebody who works a crime scene may have also a background in, let's say, chemistry. And they may be using different reagents to find blood or gunshot residue. That's not what I do. But I physically reconstruct a site. One of the main things that we do in forensic engineering, such as myself, accident reconstruction is what it is that we have the ability to go and capture data, collect facts from a site, whether it's an accident or a murder or what have you. And then what we do is we interpret what we're finding and try to, again, put ourselves in a position to answer questions about how an event occurred, or maybe limit what could have occurred, or maybe what didn't occur.
Okay, so have you ever been qualified by state or federal court to testify about a shooting incident reconstruction? For instance, in Wake County, North Carolina.
Yes.
And what was that? Was that in federal court?
That was in federal court.
And were you allowed to testify as an expert?
Yes.
Okay. Now, let me move on to, and I believe the name of that case is Michael Morgan versus Wake County Sheriff's Office, correct?
That is correct.
And that was 2018?
Yes.
Now, you've been involved in many more cases. Have you ever been qualified additionally to that by any federal state court to testify about a shooting incident?
Yes, I have testified in other criminal trials where the questions were just as I said, which is, where was the weapon aimed? Maybe how many shots were fired? Where were the shots fired from? Maybe the sequence of shots. Again, this is all, you know, developing an understanding of what the physical evidence tells you.
Okay. So let me move to a second area of expertise I'm going to ask you about. Tell us about what acoustics engineering is.
Well, acoustics and vibrations, or acoustics specifically, is part of mechanical engineering. It's the study of how sound moves, how it's made, how it may be, how sound may decrease over distance, the effect of sound on people. It's obviously something really important because if you're exposed to sound for long periods of time, you can lose part of your hearing. So it is a subset of mechanical engineering. And so I have testified in cases involving acoustics. My master's paper was in the area of something that I do quite often, which is the audibility of emergency vehicles. Like if a police car has a siren on and you're driving up to an intersection, you got the radio on, can you hear the siren or can you not hear the siren? Maybe it makes a difference if your window is up or down. Those types of issues, so the audibility of noise.
To do that kind of analysis, do you have to do some sort of reconstruction oftentimes?
Yes, often with acoustics, you can definitely look at it theoretically, but I typically test it because it's something that is readily testable.
Okay. And you've been qualified, again, in at least one state. You've been qualified multiple times to testify as to acoustical engineering.
Yes.
And one of those cases was Koudalakis versus CSX in state court in Richmond, Virginia. Is that correct?
Yes.
And many other times also.
Yes.
Okay, the last area of expertise, all these are engineering related, correct?
They are.
Is accident reconstruction involving vehicles.
Yes.
And you've done that more than you've probably done the other two, correct?
It is. Motor vehicle accidents, and again, it's just because there's so many of them. Throughout my career of 36 years, I've looked at probably a couple thousand motor vehicle wrecks.
And again, you apply these same principles, data, and then you do engineering analysis of it, mathematics, trigonometry, those kinds of things. Is that correct?
Yes.
And you have been qualified multiple times on that issue.
Yes.
As an expert to give an opinion.
Yes.
And again, going back to the other two, you've been qualified as an expert to give an opinion by many courts, several courts in shooting incident reconstruction, acoustics engineering, and in motor vehicle reconstruction. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
Your Honor, I move that this witness be qualified as a expert in the three areas I just mentioned.
Mr. Heads of State. He's admitted without objection as an expert in the fields that he's offered.
Okay, so let's start off with the shooting incident reconstruction, okay?
Yes.
Now, have you prepared a PowerPoint? Well, back off. Back off. Strike that. Were you hired by myself and Mr. Griffin to do some analysis on what occurred at Moselle that resulted in the deaths of Paul and Maggie Murdaugh?
Yes.
And let's first of all talk about what's the process generally, and then we're going to put this PowerPoint up, or do you want me to put the PowerPoint up first?
I can speak to that generally. So, okay. I think I mentioned it earlier, but really the first steps in any investigation, if it's a little investigation, big investigation, my job and the people I work with and people in other companies that do what we do, you go collect facts. And in this case, this is typical, facts were collected. The crime scene was processed. There were a lot of pictures taken, things like that, by SLED. So that's one place that I can get facts. I typically do, and I did in this case, I go collect facts myself. So I went to Moselle, and it had changed. I went there about 18 months after the murders. I went in October of 22, but I was able to measure the Moselle property and look at the physical evidence, what was remaining, and then I was able to use that in conjunction with what SLED had done, because SLED had collected a lot of evidence at the scene that I looked at.
Now, some of the evidence collected by SLED that you looked at were measurements made by SLED agent Worley either the night of or soon after the incident to things like shell casings, right?
That is correct.
And there's also pictures of those shell casings, correct?
Yes.
And also the location of Maggie's body and Paul's body. There were measurements done on both of those, correct?
Yes.
And did Agent Worley also find two bullet holes, one in the doghouse, one in the quail pen?
Yes.
And did she take measurements there?
She did.
And were those important to your calculations?
They were. It was what I was looking at least my role in looking at the crime scene or the site of the crime, the questions that I was being asked.
Okay, so do we have the PowerPoint, please? Okay, you can see that. Okay.
Object to showing this. Nothing's been
entered. Oh, I apologize. I got ahead of myself. This is a disk of this PowerPoint. Any objection?
Is it the
no objection.
Your Honor, we offer into evidence defendant's exhibit number 143. Without objection, I believe.
Submit without objection.
And Your Honor, okay, let's just walk through the PowerPoint. Go to the next slide, please. Okay, now this is titled Shot Trajectories as Measured by Special Agent Worley. Are these what we're talking about, measurements she made?
Yes.
Okay, next slide, please. Quail pen. Go ahead. Now, what are we looking at here?
So this is what I call the quail pen, and it's a small animal cage. It's been referred to, but like it's a bird cage, and it's up against the building or the barn, the hangar. I think it's been called several things. It's up underneath the roof.
Okay, now if you went perpendicular to that out, would you run into the dog kennels?
Yes.
Okay, so this is across from the dog kennels, and that is the quail pen.
Yes, and this particular photograph was taken the night of the murder. So the first few pictures just show the points of evidence that were of interest to me. And then what happened later on, it was the next month, I believe it was July the 6th, Special Agent Worley went back and actually took some measurements. She used basically a common technique where you try to get more information about these bullet holes.
Okay, next. What is this we're looking at?
It's a little bit closer view of the quail pen, and what you have there on the side of the quail pen, so it would be the side that's really facing the crime scene.
Right.
It's made out of like a fiberboard, a little bit more robust than cardboard. It's like a fiberboard, so you can penetrate it easily, and there was a bullet hole basically in the center of it.
Okay, next slide. That would be that bullet hole?
That is the bullet hole, and if you were able to zoom in a little bit and look carefully, you'd be able to see what's called a bullet wipe. It's down. It's, you know, if that was a tiny little clock, it'd be just under 3 o'clock. And so when I looked at that, it looked like the bullet was on an upward trajectory, a small one, but an upward trajectory. And what the bullet wipe is when the bullet comes out of the barrel of the gun, it's going to have products of the bullet being fired. And when it enters sheetrock or a car door or a piece of plywood, you commonly see that lead-in mark where the bullet goes into a piece of material.
Can we make that bigger? There we go. Okay. So how about step down here for just a second, and there's a pointer right behind you. Your Honor, may he step down? Grab that pointer right there. You point out for the jury, please, that you call it a bullet wipe.
Yeah, so when you look at the entry, the entrance of a bullet hole into the surface like this, and this is the piece of gray cardboard, there's some tearing here, but if you look over here in the side, that's what's called the bullet wipe mark, and that shows you the direction that is coming from. So it's coming from where I'm standing. And it's a little bit below, like if you could draw a straight line through there, that would be even with the horizon. It's a little bit below that. So right away, that told me that this bullet, when it penetrated this piece of material here, that it was traveling upwards and from right to left.
Okay. Let me see the next slide, just in case. Okay. Any way to make that a little bigger? While he's doing that, what are we looking at here?
This is a photograph from Special Agent Worley's trip to the crime scene. I think it was the next month, July the 6th.
What's going on here?
So this bullet, it penetrates this quail pen and actually goes through the wall of the hangar, too. It goes through several layers of material. And a common technique to try to figure out what is the angle of that shot, you take something like this. Typically, they're fiberglass, so they don't bend. They're perfectly straight. And you insert that rod through the bullet hole. And then what you do is you measure this rod. So right now, she's measuring what's called the vertical angle. So if I was measuring angle of the shot, like to the TV right here, so vertical angle is this way. Was the bullet going up, or was it going down, or was it going straight in?
And what did that, did you look at a close-up picture of that, and did you also look at her notes?
Yes.
And what was her conclusion about the angle, you say vertical angle, the angle going into the quail pen, was it going up, was it going down? And by, I guess you gauge this in degrees, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so was it going up or down?
It was going up.
At what degree?
So the bolt was traveling upwards, which is consistent with what I just showed you on the previous pictures. So her measurement that it's going up is consistent. She recorded in her notes that that was 3 degrees going up. So pretty flat, but the bolt was traveling upwards. But there are two pictures. She has one picture of it at 3 degrees and one at 1.5 degrees. So pretty close, but two different trajectories. And later on, I looked at the difference between the 1.5 and the 3.
Okay.
And we could that'll come up later, but for the purposes of me understanding what was going on here, I considered both 1.5 and 3.
And while 1.5 or 3 is not a steep incline, as it goes in, if you project that back, it's going to have, if you go 10 feet, it's going to make it. Okay. As you project it back, what, if any, difference is there on that cause on trajectory?
Okay, well, the reason this is interesting is because it's an upward traveling bullet. So if you think about the path of this bullet, for all purposes here, because we're talking about maybe 50 feet in this crime scene, it's not 400 yards. If it's 400 yards, the bullet has a curved trajectory. So here, because the area that we're considering is so small, that for all intents and purposes, it's a flat trajectory, which means that the barrel of the gun was on the same angle as that rod. Okay? And it's going down, which means if you extend that rod, if you're able to extend that rod some distance, it's going to go into the ground. So if it goes into the ground, obviously the gun can't be underground. So you know that the shooter who fired the weapon that sent the bullet into the quail pen has to be on that line. So the weapon has to be on that line, and it's going to go into the ground at some point. So that is a good piece of information, because that locks the location of the shooter, at least for one shot.
And I believe Agent Worley identified, I'm sorry, strike that. What, if any, caliber or kind of weapon did Agent Worley deduce had fired that bullet?
This was the 300 Blackout.
Okay. Now go to the next slide, please.
This is just another measurement. This may be the one that's closer to 1.5 degrees, but you can see this is called, they call them trajectory rods, which again is inserted through the multiple paths of the bullet as it went through things.
So as you look at that device, whatever that's called, one of them shows 1.5, one of them shows 3, and she wrote down 3?
Correct.
Okay. Great. Next, please. Now, what is this?
Same thing. I'm just showing the kind of the different readings that she got here. Okay. It was within a range.
Okay.
So same answer for this.
Right. Next. Okay. So what are we looking at now?
This to explain a little bit better.
Can you give me, make that a little bigger, please? Okay. So what are we looking at here?
This is to show the trajectory rod. It comes in. We've been looking at this side right here. But if you look inside, you see it kind of goes through the cage, and it goes through the back of the cage. It actually goes into the hangar or the barn, goes through the siding, and then the plywood.
So that is that same rod, except that's the inside going out. Correct?
That's the inside. I was just trying to show the technique. And this technique is a technique that is used often. There are other ways to do it, and we may talk about it later, but this is a technique that's often used to come up with this line of fire, or the path that bullet took, because if you consider the path of the bullet, you may be able to conclude something from that.
Okay, next.
It's just more of the same. This is the trajectory rod inside the cage or the quail pen.
Okay.
More of the same.
Next.
More of the same.
But these are, okay, wait one second. So these pictures depict that rod coming from the outside, going through the quail pen, and through the wall behind the quail pen.
That is correct.
And that's, you put that rod through, and then you can make some measurements outside as to trajectory, correct?
That's correct.
Easy for you to say. Next, please. Now, what is that device? What's going on there?
This is called a zero-edge protractor. So the protractor is going to measure 0 to 180 degrees. So this is Special Agent Worley. Puts it up against the side of the quail pen and drop a plumb bob down so you can get what's called the azimuth. And the azimuth is just your compass direction. So because if I have the azimuth, and this is about 41 degrees coming in from where I'm standing. So, you know, 45 degrees would be, you know, here. There's 41 degrees. 90 degrees would be straight in. So what that does is it tells you the direction of this line.
So you know, at that point, you know whether it's going up or down, and you know whether it's coming from the left or the right.
That's correct.
And as we look at that quail pen, is it coming from over here to the left, or is it coming from the right?
Well, it's coming from over here to the right.
Okay.
And then to determine exactly how, you need to go back and kind of look. You have to do it to scale, of course.
Right.
So you have to create a scale diagram, or you do what we typically do, which is we scan.
Okay. So. Let me see the next one. And is that just a close-up of the measurement, the angle?
Yes. And you can see here that it's 41 degrees.
41 degrees.
And that's what she recorded in her notes.
Okay. Next. Now, this is the doghouse. And in a minute, we're going to see a 3D rendition of this so the jury can get a little better idea of where everything is.
Yes.
But let's go ahead and talk about the doghouse next. So tell me what you see there.
So the doghouse had a bullet hole in it. It's pretty low to the ground. It's about 5.5 inches above the ground, 3 inches up from the bottom of the siding on the doghouse. And this bullet hole was going downwards, 14 degrees down. And it had an angle slightly to the left. And so kind of the same way that you can think about the one that was going up, you think about the one that's going down. So if you put a trajectory rod in, we'll see that in a second, it's going to be sticking upwards like that. So you can go up that trajectory rod to a point where it makes no sense. Like the shooter would have to be on a ladder, right? So that, what that does is it tells you where that shot came from. And it puts a limit on where that shooter could be. You know, just the same way that the shot trajectory would disappear into the ground makes no sense. You know, shot trajectory that's up at 10 feet doesn't make any difference either. I mean, it doesn't make any sense.
Right. Let me see the next slide. Okay, and what is that?
That is the 300 blackout projectile. It went into the doghouse, went into a dog bed. So you're able to dig it out. So it's... You can see that here. So, again, these are the night of the murders.
So, if it didn't go through the back wall, how does one get a trajectory off of that?
Well, in this particular case, the siding was thick enough where Agent Worley was able to put a dowel rod or a trajectory rod into that hole, unlike the quail pen, which is very thin. So, a very thin material... It's considered thin if the thickness of that material is much less than the length of the bullet, right here. So in a thin material, there's some special considerations with thin materials versus thick materials, but the doghouse had siding and wood construction, so it's thicker. So a thick material is going to be more in line with the length of the bullet and even longer. So you can still get the trajectory with reasonable accuracy in this particular case.
Okay, next slide, please. Okay, now what is that?
This is the same process here at the doghouse where...
Can you blow that up for me, please? There you go. So what do we see?
This is the trajectory rod. This is a dial protractor. It just uses gravity to tell you what the angle is.
And what was the angle?
14 degrees down.
It's coming in at a 14 degree. The bullet's coming... There you go. It's coming down into the doghouse at a 14-degree angle.
That's correct.
Okay. Next, please. And what is this?
Zoomed in so you can see. So okay. There's 90, and it's over about 76 degrees or so. So that makes it.
That's a 14-degree downward path?
Yes.
Next. Now, this is that plumbob thing and azimuth thing, right?
Azimuth. So if this is, this shows you the compass direction of the shot, where it's coming from. And here, it's she measured 7 degrees. She recorded 6 degrees off of there, but it's somewhere there. All you really got to know, it's not straight into the doghouse. It's a little bit of an angle, about 6 or 7 degrees.
Okay. Next. And that's just a close-up of the same thing.
Yeah, so there's 90, so the plumbob would be right here if it was going straight into the doghouse, but it's a little bit to the left.
About six or seven degrees. Okay, next. Now tell me what this is.
So this is Agent Worley's diagram, and it's not the scale. And these are just the lines that I drew in to begin with, you know, before I really did much work in the case. And it's clearly not to scale because, for instance, from the small animal cage, that pole is 24 feet about. And you can see that Maggie's body is, you know, 17 feet long. You know, it says not to scale. But what that doesn't do for you, it really doesn't tell you, okay, we went through all that trouble to measure these. What does it tell you? And what I noticed was this, is that there was two shots, and one was into the doghouse, which was facing this way. One was into the quail pen, which is like facing the way this desk here. That's two totally different directions. So the first thing that would be good to do is to draw those lines backwards and see where they cross, right? And where they cross, is there anything of interest there? Right? Are there footprints or something? In this case, there was. But not footprints, but that's what you do here. And so the thing you're looking at is let's figure out what this is telling us, which is these two lines are going to cross somewhere.
Well, and this is not to scale, so it doesn't tell you much about
it. It doesn't really tell us much because they don't cross at the right spot.
Right. Yeah. But in terms of the relationship of different objects, we see the quail pen, and it looks like it is, again, perpendicular to the dog kennels, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Next. Okay, so this is your reconstruction. Maybe you ought to go ahead and take your room. You want to do it from down here or up there?
I'd sit up there.
Well, wait one second. Let me see what this does. Next, go ahead.
Okay. This is a AVI file.
This is
I can explain.
What, is it a video?
It is a video.
Yeah, go ahead and play it, and then we may play it again. I want you to explain it after they look at it. Go ahead. Okay, stop it right there for me, okay? Stop it right. There you go. So we see the doghouse. The quail, point where we just flew by it. That way, maybe she's starting over again. Okay, go ahead and start. There we go. So as we get right, stop it right. Not yet. There. Stop. Okay. So we see the doghouse. Point it out, please. We see the kennels. How about point those out? And I don't think we can see the quail pen yet, but it's going to be up in there, correct?
Yeah, so the quail pen's against this wall.
Okay, go ahead and start it back up. And stop it. Okay, show the jury again where the quail pen is.
Here's the quail pen.
And where's the doghouse?
The doghouse is right here.
Okay, go ahead and start it up again. Now, maybe I'll have you explain how you do this. You go ahead and take the stand again, please.
Yes.
Let me see the next slide while he's going up there. You don't need to come down for this. But this is called fly through with no roof. So you've eliminated the roof with the computer to show what it looks like. You get a better sense of perspective. Is that right?
That's correct.
And is this to scale?
It is to scale. It's very accurate. It is
kind of the modern way to measure a site. It's scanning is used all over now. I mean, from dentist offices to everything. But
we'll talk in just a minute about how you put this together and the process I think is on here. Okay, how about let that one go? And this is without, you took the roof off of the shed, correct?
I did.
Okay, go ahead. We can see the doghouse. We can see the quail pen. We can see where Maggie's body was. And we can see where Paul's body was, correct?
Yes.
Okay. How about do that one more time? That would be Maggie's body near the doghouse?
Yes.
And that would be Paul's body over here, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Keep going. And why did you do this particular visual? Does that make it easier to see where everything is relative to each other?
Yes. In the scan, you can just cut the roof off. It just makes things easier to see.
Okay.
The roof was of no importance to me.
Right. Next. Now, tell me what this represents.
Well, this is where I start constructing some lines. And this is just an overall shot. Looking straight down, like this is a bird's eye view of the scan, and the dog kennels are in the bottom right, and the hangar, the barn, is kind of in the center top of the picture, and it's just there's nothing really, you know, of this particular shot. It just illustrates what you can do, and what I did, for instance, is I drew some white lines in there. Those are measurement bars. One's 25 feet long, one's 50 feet long. But the scan itself, you can measure very accurately anywhere in this scan because this is not a picture. What it is are their points. And there's so many points. There's millions of points, and there's so many points when you put them together, it actually looks like an object, like a three-dimensional object.
So let me ask you this. The state, it's been a month, so we may not all remember. The state had, this is called a FARO. What is this called?
We call them a FARO scan. FARO is the company that builds the scanner. There are other companies like Nikon that make scanners. But a FARO scan is a laser scanner. And what it does is it sends out a laser. And when that laser hits an object, it returns back to the scanner. It gets reflected back. Depending on how much time that takes, it can figure out how far away that object is. And we're talking about a very small point. And then what it does is, because the scanner is spinning around this way and a mirror is spinning this way, it knows where that point is in space. And then what it also does to make it look better, it spins the camera around, and then the camera applies more information to all these points. So what you end up with are millions of points. Like if you scan the front yard of this courthouse, you get trees, you get pine, you get people kind of ghosting by as they walk through the scan. Picks up everything.
So does law enforcement use FARO?
Yes, they did do a FARO scan. I have seen their fly through like we just showed you, but that's the thing that I've seen. So they did, again, it is a common technique in our field used to measure things because you don't have to take 100 measurements with a tape measure, and it's much more accurate.
And SLED, I believe you just said, did a FARO scan of the same murder site.
They did.
And I think we played it. It's been a month, but I think I played it a month ago.
Objection, Your Honor.
Objection sustained.
At some point in this trial, are you familiar with the fact of whether SLED's FARO scan was played?
Yes.
Okay. And is their FARO scan as detailed as yours?
I would have to compare them, but it should basically be the same thing. Their scan and our scan should be the same because it's a highly precise instrument. And
okay. Let's go to the next one.
The only difference would be they did it in July.
And you did it in?
October of 22.
Okay. Now, what does this depict?
So the next thing I wanted to do, other than reconstruct the shot trajectories, like we said before, I wanted to know where the evidence markers were. So What this here is, I took Special Agent Worley's measurements. She had measured to a bunch of different things, including the head and feet of the victims, and then also to those little yellow evidence marker tags. And the evidence markers that I was most interested in were numbers 2 through 7, which would have been the empty cartridge cases from the 300 blackout. But what I did was is I created a CAD diagram to scale of Agent Worley's measurements.
Okay, what's a CAD diagram?
It's just computer-aided drawing. It's a drawing package, so you can do a scale diagram. Now, she did this just, you know, measuring from a pole, a post, and whatnot, but we have a technique. When we scanned in 22, obviously these markers were not there, but we had lots of photographs of them. And so there's a methodology that we can use where we can flatten the picture taken the night of the murders, and then we can match that to the scan. So then once you match that photograph to the scan, you can actually place in objects that no longer exist very accurately.
Now, this FARO program, as you indicated, was used by SWAT, is it used by other law enforcement agencies?
Yes.
Very common. It is used by hundreds, thousands of them?
Yes.
And they do the same process that you do?
Yes.
Okay. So once you got this, and what is this? This is a, tell me what this process is.
Yeah, so this is Special Agent Worley's hand measurements.
Put on a computer program.
Put on a computer program, and because I wanted to put the evidence markers in my scan. And so you have the scan of the Moselle property, but then I can put stuff in there too. I could put a car in there, I could put a body, or I could put these evidence markers. So I used this to check what we did, which we used photographs and the techniques of putting the evidence markers where they belong.
Okay. Next slide, please. What does this depict?
So what this is then I overlaid Agent Worley's drawing, the one that we just looked at, over my scan. And I use that, if you were able to zoom in a little bit, I don't know if it's how, maybe a little bit hard for you guys to see, but those circles with the crosses in them are Special Agent Worley's measurements. And then either touching them or inside of them are the evidence markers that got placed by what we call reverse camera projection, which is just a fancy name of, we can take the information from a photograph taken the night of the murders, and we can attach that to our scan. And then if we want to, we can put missing objects in there, which is what we did here.
Okay, go ahead.
And there's an example of it there.
Can you make that a little bigger, please? So what is, yeah, that's perfect right there. What does that show?
It shows the same thing. So we use the reverse camera projection method to get the yellow evidence markers in the scan. And you can see there, Special Agent Worley's measurements are usually right beside it, but you have to remember she was probably stretching a tape measure. So it all makes sense. So it agreed. So what that tells you have a high degree of confidence that these markers are in the correct place.
Okay, next. Now, what does this depict?
Well, it's a it is a video.
Okay,
go
ahead and play that.
Show the whole screen.
Yeah, we need the whole screen to play the video, please. Okay. What are we seeing here?
So this is fading back and forth between the scan world or the computer world and reality. So you can see there that that's a crime scene photo that was taken the night of the murders. And what that is, it's showing you the comparison between this world that we built to try to understand what was the physical evidence telling us.
Well, picture taken on the night of the murders, is this a complete picture or have you dropped some things out?
No, it's a complete picture. You know, some items may have been moved by the time this picture was taken. I would have to go back and see it.
Oh, so this picture was taken by you in October.
Oh, no. This is the night of the murders here.
Okay. Okay, next. Okay, so go ahead. Quail pen shot trajectory. Okay, so tell us what this is.
Okay, so I picked a place in the scan to start laying in those lines. So now we've talked about how we built this up. So let's put the trajectory of the two shots that were measured and see what it tells us. And so I just chose a point. You're looking straight into the side of the doghouse. The sheet in the foreground there would be Maggie's body. And then you can see the evidence markers. There's three, four. You can see five and six over by the sheet.
Right.
12 is something else. I believe it was may have even been bullet fragments. But 3, 4, 5, and 6 there are empty cartridge cases from the bullets that were fired.
Okay, go back out a little for just a second. There you go. I see somebody standing over here on the right. What is that?
That was probably one of my engineers or somebody I work with who was doing some other task.
Okay.
So when you scan, if you stand still long enough, it'll scan you.
Scan you in. Okay.
Yes.
Next. Now, what are those two green lines?
The two green lines are the shot trajectories into the quail pen.
And why are there two?
Because one is at 1.5 degrees up and one is at 3 degrees up.
Okay. And this projection, in terms I understand, if you took the dowel that she put through the hole.
Objection sustained.
Sorry, Your Honor, I was trying to get it in terms I understand. Let me see if we can get to the same place. Tell us what that depicts in terms that I can understand.
Yes, so that is the flight path of the bullet somewhere along that line. And so it's trigonometry. It's not any more complicated than that. I don't know if that's too complicated for you, but it's just trigonometry.
These lines, are they put in there by you manually, or are they computed by the program?
Well, the lines are put in by me on the computer program. And again, they're the 1.5 degrees, 3 degrees. The importance of them is that's where the barrel of the gun has to be perfectly in line with those two green lines. But right now, without knowing anything else, you could slide that gun up and down that green line and it could be anywhere, right? So, but you start looking at other pieces of evidence. And so what you would have is, well, what other pieces of evidence we have. I looked at this and I said, well, where does the shot trajectory go? Well, it goes almost right over Maggie's body, very close to it, right close to the feet. That's one thing. The second thing is there is a collection of empty cartridge cases right to the line. So if I'm facing the quail pen, there's a collection of cartridge cases to my right.
And what's your understanding about the ejection of cartridge cases from blackout?
Typically, it should be to the right and to the back somewhat.
Okay.
It depends. But so that was a piece of information, which is that starts to, as I said before, sometimes what you're looking at what you can determine, but maybe you can limit where something happens. So, you know, that is a point of interest. Well, you have a pile of cartridge cases. They go right beside the shot trajectories. That's an important point.
Okay, next. Okay, so what are we seeing here?
So that is a shooter that I constructed. And what this is, it's actually a scan of a person. So you can get scans of people. In this particular case, just for the purposes of this trial, I stripped all the textures off this person. So there's no clothing or hair or skin color, anything like that. So it's just more almost like a robotic looking figure. It is holding a 300 blackout weapon, a model of one. And so when I started examining those shot trajectories, a couple things were apparent. One is it would be really hard for anybody to be shooting that shot from the shoulder.
because remember the shot's going up. It's only 4 feet two off the ground.
What is it? The entrance wound? The where it goes into?
Yeah, the entry point. It's only 4 feet two off the ground, and it's going up, which means that even if you're fairly short person, to get that trajectory, you'd have to walk all the way up to the quail pen to get it to work. So what I was seeing here is that the most likely way that that shot was made was from a low position, like shooting low on the hip. So I took this scanned in person with a blackout, and I pushed the gun down about as far as I could push it.
When you say about as far as you could push it, what do you mean by that?
Well, eventually, at some point, you have to have your hand on the trigger and the gun. And so instead of having the person stand straight up, too, I just put them in a shooting position. I don't know what the position of the shooter was, but this is a thought process. Okay, what is this telling us? So that's what I did here.
And what degree line is that one on?
That's on the 1.5 degree.
Okay. Next. And what does this depict?
That's the exact same shooter, except that shooter has its barrel on the 3-degree line.
Okay. But he would be on the other side of Maggie's body and on the other side of the doghouse.
Correct.
Okay. Next. Okay. Now, this has two individuals in it. What's the one behind?
So those are the two. So the shooter, oh, okay. The shooter behind is the 1.5 degree. The shooter in front is the 3 degree. So that kind of gives the range of this person being able to make that shot. And so to me, because of several different factors, it's much more likely that the angle into the quail pen was flatter than 3 degrees, which we talked about before. One of the main reasons is there's no shell casings over behind the doghouse.
So this person up front, what did you say about shell casings?
There's no shell casings anywhere close to that person.
And I guess, can you demonstrate for us how you're depicting this person's holding a gun? I mean, you say from the hip.
Yes.
What does that mean? How about demonstrate, if that's okay, Your Honor?
So what I would say is that what I did for this purpose is, instead of having it here, I put it down here, about as low as I could go.
Okay. And within, like, a shooting stance, like a shooting position. You're not aiming, but at least you're not aiming in the traditional sense, but you're...
If you're aiming, it'd be on your shoulder, right?
Right. Okay. So I stretched that gun down until I could just still keep my hand, like I was shooting a gun.
Now, from the shoulder, where generally would they be? To have that downward shot.
It's really hard to put a shoulder shot on that trajectory just because it's so low. Because even a small person going like this, 4'2", even if you put the barrel on the quail, then it'd be above the hole. So it just doesn't make any sense.
Okay, next slide, please. So this is without the guy up front because you concluded this is where the person would have been.
Yes, for a person of this height, this is to me, because of its proximity or closeness to the empty shell casings.
Okay. Next. Now let's look at the doghouse trajectory shot. Next. Okay, now explain that green line.
The green line here is the shot trajectory into the doghouse. And this is the same shooter again. And it looks like he's standing on the sheet there, but all that would tell me, if this did occur, then the body was not there.
This was a shot that would have come before the body fell to the ground.
That is correct. And so, again, you have a shooter low on the hip. That's where that person would have to be to follow that upward line. So the same exact shooter. Now that shooter is shooting down. I slid that person on the line until it was shooting down. And what I discovered was it's basically in the exact same spot. You know, maybe one step away, maybe two steps away, but
the two shots are made from very close to each other.
Right. So now what we've done is the two shots cross each other at a point, and at that point is right beside where the shell casings were ejected, relatively close to it.
Okay. Now, you don't know where Maggie was when these shots were made. Is that correct?
Correct.
So we heard from, I think, one of the state's witnesses that... Strike that. What, if anything, did we hear from the state's experts about the relative position of Maggie and whoever shot her?
The only thing that I heard was is that maybe two of the shots were done at less than 3 feet because of stippling to the skin.
And what about the relative position of the shooter and her prior to that?
Nothing specific or definitive. Okay.
So, let's see the next one. What is that?
This is a shooter, because this shot's going down. This shooter is shooting from the shoulder, which can be done with this shot. And if you're shooting from the shoulder, you got to be further back. So that's just to illustrate. That's the range of possibility, you know, from the shoulder, from the hip.
Or down low, those two we just saw. Is that also consistent with where the shell casings are?
It is. That could be consistent, too.
Okay. Next slide, please. Both shots. Go ahead. So what does this depict?
So this is the shooter making both shots. And you'll see, there's a couple different angles I could show you, but they're really close. And they're in the right location relative to the empty shell casings.
Okay.
So what that says, I'm not saying it's exactly there because there's some variables to it, but I find it interesting that the two shot trajectories cross at a point where both shots can be made, and they're at the right location relative to those empty shell casings. So, in my opinion, when these two shots were made, at least these two shots, that the shooter was standing right in that area.
Okay, next. And what does this depict?
This is the same thing I just described, except a little bit different angle. So there you may have a shooter taking two steps forward, depending on which one was fired first.
Right.
Or two steps backwards. But, you know, within a generally small area, those were those shots were fired from.
Okay, next. Is that the same?
That is the same thing. That is, you know, the shooter's from the hip. If you have the shooter shooting from the hip, it makes a lot of sense that with a little bit of movement, the shooter can produce both of those shots and have it agree with the evidence that Special Agent Worley collected.
Next. Okay, now we're going to don't go to let's get to that in just a minute. Based on your analysis of, and tell us how you came to conclude the range of heights for the person shooting from those distances. Tell us how that works.
Okay, so we're able to locate the weapon, where the weapon was, and that's...
Now, when you say locate the weapon, what do you mean by that?
Locate the weapon on the green line. Okay. So
you say locate the weapon on, is it the muzzle? Is it
the whole barrel?
The whole barrel.
Right, okay. Because the bullet starts its path inside the barrel, and when it leaves the barrel, it finds the target.
Okay, so you can slide that barrel up and down the green line?
Correct.
Okay, tell us how you get to a height for the shooter.
So for the purposes of what I've been showing you is that I started putting different height people in the trajectory analysis. And so what I've been showing you is a person that's 5'2".
Person's how tall? The shooter's how tall?
5'2".
Could be someone a little taller crouching down a little bit?
Could be.
5'3", 5'4"?
Yes.
So between 5'2 and 5'4"?
Yes.
The shooter.
Because what happens if, let's say, if you put a 5'4 person even, or 5'5", 5'6", in kind of that shooting position from the hip, you've got to move them all the way up to the quail pen. And it doesn't make any sense there because there's no shell casings. And it starts to not make any sense. Why would a person stand right in front of the quail pen a few feet away and shoot into it?
And as you slide it back, what happens in terms of the... And this is all trigonometry? These are angles?
It's just trigonometry. Okay. So, again, you have 5'2 people. What happens is if I move those people back...
Take the quail pen to begin with.
Yeah, with the quail pen, if you start to move the shooter, the quail pen back, then you're down to, you start getting to, you know, less than 5'2". put to very quickly because that shot is going up. And what you have here is that, you know, this is as far back as basically I could justify putting a 5'2 shooter here.
And how did you come to 5'2? I mean, what did you look at any data?
Well, again, these are actual people that were scanned in. And so these are 5'2. What happens is, for instance, if you I tried it with a 5'4, I tried it with a 5'9.
Why didn't that work?
Because it puts the person under the shed close to the quail pen. Doesn't make much sense being under there. There are no shell casings there. So in order to get the shooter at the cross of the two shot trajectories near the empty casings, then you've got to lower that shot.
Okay, next slide, please. Okay, let's look at this. Okay, some measurements. We don't need to look at each one of these, but go ahead. Go ahead. Go ahead. Go ahead. Now, let's hold on for 1 second before we go to that. So in terms of Alec Murdaugh, who is, how tall is he?
6'3", 6'4".
Okay. And you took a measurement of him this morning, correct?
Yes.
And what did you measure?
I measured to his kneecap.
To his kneecap.
Yes.
And how much, what was the distance between the bottom of his foot and his kneecap?
25 inches.
Okay, now explain why that's relevant to what we're talking about.
Well, I mean, the obvious question is, well, what if you were 6'4 and not 5'2? What does that mean? So what that means is that the shooting hand, the bottom of the shooting hand, for somebody the height of Alex Murdaugh would be right at and below his kneecap.
So his shooting hand would be below his kneecap?
Yes.
What does that tell you?
Well, it puts the shooter or whoever fired the weapon, if they were that tall, it puts them in an unrealistic shooting position. It's not an aiming position. It's not a shooting position. It would be something other than a shooting position where you were on your feet. So it would be, it would be very difficult. You would have to be bending over and have your shooting hand down at or below your kneecap. And what's important about that to me is that it just makes it very unlikely that a tall person made that shot.
More likely that a person between 5'2 and 5'4 fired those shots, correct?
Yes. Yes.
Can I have, maybe. Can I have a red or black pen or something? You know, I think I'll take the red one. Okay, yeah, that's fine. That's great. Right. Thanks. So, I had one of these, the shots you had with the shooters and their alignment blown up. Can you step down here, please? And then the point. And you stand over here. And so, explain to the jury why they've got to be 5'2". This is blown up. Why would it be 5'2"? I mean, how, if this guy moves forward this way, or either one of them moves forward, what happens to the barrel of the gun?
Yeah, so what happens is if you move them forward, they can be taller up until a point where we talked about before. At some point in time, even shooting from the hip, you still have to be very close to the quail pen. If I move them back,
either two things have to happen is they have to be even shorter than 5'2", or they have to be in some unnatural or kind of like an unreasonable shooting position. I mean, obviously you could have somebody laying on the ground taking a shot. They could be really low of any height, right? So, but what I'm doing here is that as you move these people back, the gun has to be lower and lower and lower to the ground. When you move it forward, the gun has to be higher. So then you start looking at, well, where are the shell casings? The shell casings are here. So if you move a person back, let's say where they're laying on the ground, right, and they're shooting like in a sniper position, like on their elbows and laying down flat, there's no shell casings back there because the shell casings are being ejected to the right, maybe to the back, we don't really know. But at least it's going to be back here. This area where Maggie's body was found, where the collection of empty shell casings are found, because some of these were close range, but some of them are spread over here, is going to put the shooter here. Well, it certainly puts the weapon there. And then then what you have to do is go through the thought process of how can somebody hold the weapon that height off the ground.
Now, if you've got a tall person and they're coming this way towards the quail pen, let's say a 6'3", 6'4" person, can they? How close would they have to be to the quail pen to shoot the bullet at that angle into the quail pen?
Well, it would be difficult. It wouldn't be either a hip shot or a shoulder shot. You would have to, for somebody who's tall, because again, I have a tape measure, but the hole in the quail pen is at 4'2". Okay. So.
We got one right there.
So let's just say.
I see a sticker or something.
You need what? A sticker?
So the quail pen shot is right here.
I have a sticker right there. Okay, so that's the height it went into the quail pen.
Right. 5'10".
Right.
Right. Shoes all maybe 5'11". Right. So it's going 3 degrees up. So there's, I'm saying that's about flat. Let's just say that's 3 degrees. Now I'm standing at the quail pen. I would have to do like that. Or I could do this. Right. Not from the hip. I'd have to come in here like this, which of course is possible. Right. Just like that.
What about 6'4"?
And if you're 6'4", it would be, you know, a lot taller than I am. And so you would, you know, you would have to go through that thought process of how the shooter could
and of course, up. As you come back off the quail pen, the only place you see shell casings are back here.
Yes. The empty shell casings, there's some right by the body, there's one underneath the body. And then I believe it's 2, 3, and 4 are here. 5, 6, and 7 are here, but 2, 3, and 4 are here. Like the shells are being ejected to the right and maybe slightly backwards.
And so, can you say to a degree of engineering certainty, more probably than not, that whoever shot this shot or these shots, well, first of all, the quail pen shot was 5'2" to 5'4"?
That is the most likely explanation, yes.
Okay. And we know that Alec is 6'4".
Yes.
So could you say to a degree of engineering certainty, more probably than not, that Alec Murdaugh on the night of June 7th did not fire that shot into the quail pen?
In my opinion, it's very unlikely that he fired that shot.
Okay, now, in reviewing the SWED file, did you see whether or not they did any analysis like this? Have you seen any charts, any pharaohs, anything indicating that SWED ever looked at these shot angles before?
No.
Okay, go ahead and get the video. Your Honor, this is probably going to go another extended, probably another hour before I'm done. I just look at see it's 1 o'clock. I don't know what you want me to continue, or do you want to take a lunch break?
Well, we can break for lunch now. That's what you want to do. Ladies and gentlemen, we will addressing the jury. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll break now and return at 2:15. Please do not discuss the case.
That wraps up the second segment of coverage here on the 21st of February, 2023, day 19 in the trial of Alec Murdaugh. There is more to come. I'm Tony Bruschi. Stay with us.